Let's go, girls.
Listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am so thrilled today to be joined by Professor Kathy Eden of Princeton. She is a professor of sociology and public affairs. We are going to talk about poverty and school vouchers, and she's going to drop some knowledge bombs. We're going to have a discussion that will hopefully help us all better understand the nature of poverty in the United States, especially acute poverty, as well as what actually are these universal voucher systems going to bring about in our public school systems? And is there perhaps a bit of history that we could learn from that might help us understand our present moment better? But before we get to that, I just want to talk about some of the things that basically went down on Friday when I didn't have my regular show, because, wow, it was sure a lot. And perhaps not at the top of the list, but certainly worthy of note, there are rape and sexual assault charges now pending against Florida GOP Chair Christian Ziegler. Yeah. The facts here are pretty outstanding. His wife is the founder of, what is it called? It's such a ridiculous organization. Moms for Liberty or some such nonsense. These are the book banners. Okay. Of course, started out in DeSantis's Florida, and it's spread like a bad communicable disease across the country. And interesting that there's going to be an echo in some of our discussion today, particularly when we come to these universal voucher discussions. We're going to tie a bow on this. You know, all this stuff is of a whole, as I often talk about on this show. And isn't it absolutely unbelievably hypocritical that a woman who has made it her business to police thought in public schools while having absolutely no credentials to do so, who wants to suppress and oppress the LGBTQI plus community, both in the books that are written about their experiences and their availability to children, but also by extension, oppress those children in our public school systems, that she and her husband have been involved in a three-way love affair of some time, and now the woman that was part of this three-way love affair has accused her husband, GOP chair, of rape. You cannot make this stuff up. It simply defies any logic, any through line, and I will say any moral core. So, you know, that happened on Friday. I don't know if you missed it, but I watched good pieces of it. DeSantis and Governor Newsom from California had a debate. It was sort of like a proxy debate, GOP versus the Democratic Party. And Governor Newsom on Fox, which is where the debate was held, moderated by none other than Sean Hannity, who probably gave Governor DeSantis the answers to the exam ahead of time. Gavin Newsom just took DeSantis absolutely to the woodshed. If you haven't seen clips of this, it is pretty outstanding. That happened. We have House Speaker Mike Johnson apparently has now written the foreword to a bizarre book riddled with conspiracy theories and homophobic insults. So, yes, perfectly on brand for the GOP. That's our House Speaker. And last but not least, they expelled George Santos. That little bit of news from Friday, too. So really slow news day on Friday. I was compelled to at least acknowledge these goings on before we jump right in. And with all of that, oh, one other thing. The good news, very wonky, but I would be remiss if I did not mention this. December 1st was a really important date here in the state of Wisconsin. For a whole bunch of technical legal reasons, which I will not get into today, that was the date that after which, if Justice Janet Protasiewicz is indeed impeached, something which has no legal precedent, no legal merit, and would be anathema to both the rule of law and the rights of voters to select Supreme Court justices here in the state of Wisconsin. But if she were to be impeached and removed, December 1st was the magic date that after which it is indisputable that current Democratic Governor Evers would be able to appoint her replacement, and that justice would sit until 2031. So fear not, dear friends. Justice Janet ain't going anywhere soon because they just get another democratically appointed justice to the Supreme Court, which really serves no practical purpose. So lots of stuff in the news, but let's set that aside and join me in welcoming Professor Kathy Eden. Thank you so much for being here. We've got so much to talk about. Welcome.
I agree, Maggie. And thanks for your careful read of our work and our book and just your enthusiasm. It's just really refreshing.
I think this is, in effect, the most important public policies that can be debated are both the question of poverty and the issues surrounding public schools and vouchers right now. These have incredible impacts for all working class folks, and incredible impacts for basically what are we going to see in the coming decades from public schools and taxpayer dollars funding education, and what will that beget in terms of an informed citizenry? So much here. Just before we got on the air, Professor Eden, I was sharing with you that I actually was working on Capitol Hill. I was an intern for then Congressman Tom Barrett in 1996, which is, as some Wisconsinites will recall, when W-2, that was what it was called then, Wisconsin Works, some people called it welfare to work. There was a state law precursor. And then under the Newt Gingrich-run House of Representatives, there was this huge welfare reform package that was then signed by President Clinton on August 22nd, 1996. It was called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. Interesting wording there of the legislation. Personal responsibility and work opportunity. No, there's not any moral judgments in that name of the legislation. And I think it's important, and you're exactly the right person to help explain what existed before that law and what exists now. And we'll then turn to what happened in the ARPA aid package and what this has to do and mean for poverty in America, and especially children living in extreme poverty. So help folks remember, what was the welfare system before W-2 was adopted in 1996?
Such a great question. And the subject of my prior book, $2 a Day. So I've spent much of my career studying this system. And prior to 1996, cash welfare was an entitlement, meaning if you showed up at the welfare office and you had no income, you would get aid. And this was true in Mississippi, was true in Alabama, it was true in Wisconsin, it was true in New Hampshire. You got a lot less in Mississippi and Alabama than you did in Wisconsin and New Hampshire, because every state set their own benefit levels. So you'd get less than $200 in Mississippi, you might get $500 in Milwaukee, you'd get $700 if you were a family of three with no other income, and in some of the northeastern states. But by and large, if you had no cash and you were a mother or a parent and had dependent children, you would get aid. What the 1996 Act did is it ended that and said states could use the money pretty much however they wanted. And they have engaged in a lot of shenanigans. So some states said, well, gee, we're paying for this expensive child welfare program. Let's just use the federal welfare money to do that. Other states said, oh, let's fund anti-abortion pregnancy clinics with this money. Some states like Michigan said, let's give middle-class kids whose parents earn $80,000 a year a college scholarship to go to a fancy private college. And most egregiously in Mississippi, they said, well, gee, let's give the money over to this nonprofit who lined, you know, spent $80 million in federal taxpayer money from this program meant to aid the poorest kids in America, right? Let's take it from those kids and use it to line the pockets of rich celebrities like Brett Favre. So there have been a lot of shenanigans, but basically what's happened is that if you're poor, you have no money, you go to the state agency, they don't have to help you. And in states like Wisconsin, the number of poor families with children who are aided by the government when they hit hard times has dropped precipitously. So you could almost say that welfare is dead, cash welfare is dead in the United States. And really, other than food stamps, maybe Medicaid, if you're lucky enough to be in a Medicaid expansion state, that's all you have. That's all you have. So what we saw in the 1990s and increasingly in the 2000s was a rise in the number of families. And again, this is the subject of our book, $2 a Day, living on less than $2 per person per day in cash income. And, you know, this has not happened in America since the Great Society, really since the 1930s.
Yep. Basically, we have not had families living on $2 a day, children at this number, some 10 million plus, in extreme poverty since the Depression era.
Right.
And to emphasize the point a bit, we're going to have to go to some important messages in just a moment. The way that TANF, which is the Temporary Assistance to Needing Families, is set up is that it is a grant to states, providing states within the bounds of their, right? It's a block grant that goes to states, and they can choose to dispense it in almost any way that they elect.
Correct.
Which is why you saw the explosion of people at or below the poverty level and an explosion in the number of families and children at the level of extreme poverty following this law in 1996. Make no mistake, when the welfare rolls shrank, poor people didn't disappear. There weren't fewer poor people. They just weren't getting any support. And what I find incredibly heartless, and we could spend probably the entire week of my show talking about the morals that underlie this or the lack thereof, as if, and I feel compelled to make this point, if you are a wealthy person and one of the two parents or a parent decides to stay home and take care of their kids, that's applauded in our society. But if you are poor and you have kids and you need to stay home to take care of them, that is denigrated and punished. And the only difference between those two things is the level of wealth in the family. This. Getting older and wiser this afternoon with Professor Catherine Eden of Princeton, professor of sociology and public affairs. Before we went to break, I was just emphasizing the point that TANF, the 1996 W-2 Act, basically just created a block grant program to states. So much of that cash isn't actually going to families in need. It led to an explosion of the number of families actually in poverty. People didn't start working and magically solve their poverty problems. Oh, goodness. Thank you, federal government. No. They just became more abjectly poor and simply were not getting any help. We're going to talk about ARPA in a second because, wow, it was able to make such a dent in this, not just for poor and extremely poor folks, but for working class, regular Americans. But I just have to point this out. What was so heartless about the 1996 law was the failure to provide meaningful and affordable childcare. It is completely beyond the pale to me that you will require someone to go get work and to kick them out of any ability to receive any sort of government aid if they don't work, when the amount of money that they can earn in multiple jobs is insufficient to meet the basic needs of life and is insufficient in most cases to pay for the childcare that you have to have in order to go to work, which is required under, and that's assuming that the state that you happen to be in will give you any aid at all. It's completely crazy. So let's talk about ARPA for a minute. So in ARPA was family aid that went to millions of families. Explain to us what it was and what happened, Professor Eden.
Yeah. So you're so right about what happened to poor families with kids. They were really left without anything. And many of these moms did go to work. They were usually moms that had kids under two, and they were bearing the cost of childcare. They couldn't even pay their rent with their earnings. So their kids were really in precarious situations many times. So what happened during the pandemic is that an idea that we had advanced along with really important stalwarts like Rosa DeLauro, a congressperson
New
from
York.
Connecticut. Yeah, just for I mean, she's been on this for 20, 25 years, is a child tax credit, kind of a child allowance, really supporting the idea that every parent deserves, you know, they're raising the next generation. We should reward them for their effort. And so, during the pandemic, we had a brief moment where parents who were raising young children, almost all parents, it wasn't even means tested, except for the very wealthiest parents, got
very
a check.
Wealthy.
And we saw child poverty plummet to unbelievable levels. We saw hardship. Material hardship decreased to levels we have not seen in modern history. So that and the stimulus payments told us that we've had child poverty rates of about 15% to 20% since the 60s, since the war on poverty. We haven't been able to get them down, but we did during the pandemic. And there is so much evidence that. What did parents spend the money on? Drugs and alcohol? Turns out no.
Nope.
They spent it on the kids. So, what did parents spend the money on? They spent it on paying the rent. They spent it on nutritional food for their kids. They made sure that they didn't run short at the end of the month and were stuck eating ramen and hot dogs. It was very amazing evidence that parents do care about kids. And if you give them cash, they'll spend it responsibly. So we solved child poverty in this brief, it was miraculous.
It was.
And then of course it was not continued. And we see increasing poverty and hardship and all of the ill effects that we reversed during the pandemic are coming back to us now.
And there was a sort of a two-step that President Biden led. It was not only what you're talking about, which were these direct aids, which were periodic. This is different than the earned income tax credit, right? Which doesn't work. The data, it works to some extent, but the earned income tax credit you get once. What's different about the program that existed under ARPA and what you have suggested in your research is that the periodic nature of the payments is what is critical, because poor folks live paycheck to paycheck. Many middle-class folks do. Many upper middle-class folks do. It is actually an economic feature, not a bug in our system. And it's the periodic nature of those payments that help lift people out of being on the brink or falling off the edge. The other thing that President Biden did was the Child Care Stabilization Grant, which came online in 2021. It just expired. We have a child care crunch in Wisconsin. Child care rates are jumping. People expect them per child to go up potentially 40% here in the state of Wisconsin. The GOP, both in the federal government and here in the state government, has refused to act on Democratic proposals to help subsidize childcare facilities, which makes, again, these work requirements especially, especially pernicious. Here's a statistic from the state of Wisconsin. Per year, the average amount cost of childcare per child in the state of Wisconsin, and it's more for infants and newborns, is $13,000 a year. We haven't talked about rent. We haven't bought an ounce of food.
And those workers, by the way, are still inadequately paid. And so what most people in other countries, most other countries do is they socialize the costs of raising kids. I mean, we privatize it. We have an inadequate minimum wage. We have inadequate worker protection. So we put all of the burden on families. But really, you know, it is to the benefit of all of us that our children are protected and raised in the best possible circumstances so they can thrive as adults and support the rest of us as we retire.
It's, if we don't help socialize these costs and recognize that parenting is work, and it is probably some of the work with the greatest amount of dignity and the greatest amount of impact on our collective welfare as a society, that is a shift of thinking that we're being faced with these questions. And what happened in ARPA and with the grant program for childcare that President Biden put in place, you have shown that your ideas that you have talked about, Professor Eden, work, and they work indisputably, and that these moralistic objections rooted in prosperity theology, which is garbage, are simply talking points with no basis in any data-driven analysis. I'm going to take a breath here, because what brought me to you was the recent article that you and a few of your fellow researchers published in the Daily Beast, talking about segregation academies and how universal vouchers are going to bring us to that place. We're going to turn the page. These are all of a whole, folks. You're not going to want to miss it. We're going to continue with Professor Kathy Eden of Princeton. When we come back, we're going to talk about voucher systems and how they're leading us right down the Primrose Pass back to separate and certainly not equal. Here on the Maggie Dawn Show, keep it locked, everybody, on the Civic Media Radio Network. Too big to hang out, slowly lurching toward your favorite city. Pierced through the heart, but never killed. Did you hear my covert narcissism? Like disguise as altruism, like some kind of consciousness. I wake up screaming from dreaming. One day I'll watch as you leaving in life. Welcome back, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn, joined by Professor Kathy Eden of Princeton's Sociology and Public Affairs Departments. She's testified before Congress. She's certainly making me smarter and hopefully all of us smarter. Before we start talking about universal vouchers, I wanted to emphasize this point about your work and what we saw with both of President Biden's initiatives during the pandemic that helped raise 5+ million children out of poverty. And that is that these direct child tax credits, or a universal childhood allowance, is superior to what our current status is for, quote, welfare, which is the post-1996 W-2, TANF, whatever you want to talk about. There's SNAP benefits if you can get them and sustain them, and then there's Medicare and Medicaid, and then maybe if your state actually is giving out temporary assistance to needy families in a meaningful way, there's that. Why what you propose as a universal childhood allowance, why it's better than our current system, and why it's also better than the system that existed before W-2. And that's for two clear reasons. The first is it's actual aid to families, as I understand it, and you explained last segment. And the second thing is that unlike the welfare programs that existed before 1996, the universal childhood allowance is actually pro-work. And what I mean by that, what you mean by that, what you explain so ably in your book and the articles, there's a great article in The Atlantic. Go Google Catherine Eden. You will have good reading materials to carry you through the entire holiday season. It's pro-work because unlike the system that existed before 1996, if you were receiving welfare benefits, every dollar you earned in from a job would actually decrease your aid benefit, which created some not great incentives, one could argue. But by creating a generally applicable, reasonable, means-tested, universal childhood allowance, it makes it pro-work. So you go and get the job in addition to the support, you will put that money in your pocket from that job. That is why it is so effective at actually lifting people out of poverty. And I think that's such a critical, it's better than what we got now, and it's better than what we had before. And that's why we should be advocating for it. The book is called Injustice of Place. I promised you that I would talk about it. This is a book by Professor Eden, her frequent co-researcher and co-writer, H. Luke Schaefer, and Timothy J. Nelson. I want to shout that out. The book that addresses our welfare systems and came out in the midst of W-2 is called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Excuse me, that was published in 2015. She's got articles that date around that time. You've testified before Congress. Thank you for all of your work. And here's what. Universal vouchers are sweeping the United States. In the last, what is it, basically year and a half, I think something like 7 states have put in place universal vouchers, or the functional equivalent, also called educational savings accounts. Let's start with a definition first. Tell everybody what a universal voucher is and why it's called universal.
So let's go back again to history, because the Injustice of Place points out that the most disadvantaged places in our nation have been disadvantaged for decades, a century, 2 centuries, right? And part of the reason why they continue to be so disadvantaged is because of these policy mechanisms linking the past to the present. So universal vouchers are basically using taxpayer dollars to fund any kind of public schooling for any student. And the first time public dollars were used to fund private schools was actually in Little Rock, Arkansas, in the aftermath of Brown v. Board of Education. Whites were not going to send their kids to schools with Black kids. And so what they did is they stood up dozens and dozens of segregation academies, and they actually funneled public taxpayer dollars into these segregation schools to the detriment of the schools that were there before. And this happened all across the Deep South. Hundreds of these schools existed. And what the irony now, and often founded by white citizens' councils in these places. And what's amazing now is universal vouchers are often funding students in the South to continue to attend these same schools. So you have segregation academies in Little Rock and across the states that have adopted these vouchers. And by the way, the North is doing it too. It's just, it's disproportionately in the South because it's this legacy of racist policies.
It's rooted in racism. It's rooted in racism. And to bring this home to Wisconsin, I just have to add this one fact. I apologize for interrupting.
No, go for it.
Former gubernatorial candidate in Wisconsin, Tim Michaels, actually had universal vouchers as part of his policy platform. So this is not simply a matter of Southern states. No. And again, just to emphasize the definition here, we've had a voucher system for 32 years. It began, in fact, the first voucher system in the country was in Milwaukee Public Schools. No one, including the sponsors of that legislation and those that signed it back then, thought it would look like what it looks like now, right? And what universal means is that there's no means testing.
There's no means testing. And nor do you have to be disabled, which is another condition.
It's not
for targeted vouchers. Yeah, like Milwaukee had at the beginning.
Correct. And that means that someone who currently has their child in private school and can well afford it, then simply receives a taxpayer subsidy to send their children to the private school that they've always been attending. Correct. Arizona just put this into place. Some estimates put the number of folks that are now receiving Arizona's universal vouchers through ESAs at 75%, those that had their kids already in private schools and could well afford them. We are subsidizing rich people's kids to go to private schools of their choosing. Please continue, Professor.
And you know, in many cases, not all, because, you know, there are rural Wisconsin communities where the public schools are being torn apart by this. So, I mean, rural homogeneous communities suffer too. But in places like Milwaukee, right, in the Milwaukee suburbs, this furthers segregation. It's a vehicle to keep Black kids from white and Hispanic kids and white kids from sharing the same classrooms. And what's amazing about this is there's no evidence for learning gains. If you're a parent and you're concerned about education, and I get it. You know, the private schools, the public schools are not what they were, especially in Wisconsin, where they were a real beacon. I'm from Minnesota, so that was the other beacon. I get that. But if you want to improve the quality of education for your child and you care about the evidence, you're going to not go for universal vouchers, because there are all kinds of poor quality schools out there. You're going to increase teacher pay. We know that increasing teacher pay works. We also know that if Black kids and white kids go to the same school, so this is the exemplary research of Rucker Johnson. He's an economist at Berkeley.
Yes.
You can literally erase the Black-white test score gap, and white students do not suffer. So we know what to do, but this idea of choice is almost like trickle-down economics. You know, it's almost like magical thinking.
Oh, it is magical thinking, right?
Of course, not the free market will solve this. So none of the evidence. There's early evidence that sometimes targeted vouchers, like if kids were really trapped in very poor, you know, poor performing schools, there's some evidence that in some cases can work. But universal vouchers basically lead to the very things that Brown v. Board of Education was meant to end. And again, if you want, if you care about America and you care about children, not only your own children, but children other than your own, and you read the evidence, you would go for integration and teacher pay. This is what we know. Teacher pay. Especially beginning teachers.
Yes, there's a couple of things that I want to tease out and emphasize. Here are the facts. Voucher schools can discriminate on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, family structure, marital status, and even sometimes disability. They are not subject to individualized education program requirements that public schools are, IEPs. Oftentimes, there is no standardized curriculum. There are no fiscal responsibility metrics. There's no accountability for voucher schools. They can teach religion and any version of religion that they choose. And it's all funded by taxpayer dollars. The Wisconsin Supreme Court was the first Supreme Court in 1998 to make this distinction. Oh, this is perfectly constitutional because we're not giving tax dollars to churches. We're giving them to parents.
The schools.
They're choosing
to parents. Yes.
Right. They're going to parents who then give them to the churches to teach their kids. I want to read a quote that was in your Daily Beast article, Professor Eden, that simply sent chills down my spine. I'm just going to read the quote, and I want everyone to listen really carefully. And if I run out of time, then after we listen to some important messages, we'll translate it out of the techno-speak, Professor, so that everybody understands what was said. But here's the quote, and then we'll place it in its historical context. Here's the quote. Parents want their children to be raised and educated, free from tensions of racial conflict in the classroom, free from the frustrating drag of mass mediocrity, and free from the blight of self-styled progressive educators whose avowed aim is to turn young Americans from the established inheritance of their fathers to alien theories of collectivism and anti-white racism. There's three elements here. We don't want kids talking about tough racial stuff. That's bad wokeism. We don't want our kids dragged down by, you know, mediocre teachers and schools. We certainly don't want those progressive teachers getting their hands on students and teaching them wokeism. They need to be taught in the traditional sense that I know best. That's what that says in Common Speak. And I certainly don't want them taught to be anti-white. That's that quote. That wasn't said yesterday by Governor Ron DeSantis. It wasn't said yesterday by the woman that founded Moms for Liberty or whatever the heck it is. This was said in 1964 by the White Citizens Council to justify segregation academies that refused to admit Black students whose took tax dollars and all of the desks and hard assets and other resources out of the
buses, the mascots,
the colors, the teams, took everything from the public school system. Because here's what's interesting about Brown v. Board. It entertained a hypothetical that if we create equity and equality under the law, it will so be in reality. But it permitted this pernicious problem that we now see manifested in universal vouchers. Shame on us. Shame on them. And let's not ever let this kind of lingo go unchecked. That was the White Citizens Council in 19.
I know. It's amazing. The echoes, right? The historical echoes of exactly what we're hearing today.
It really, I mean, I read that and it took my breath away because it is the language of racial segregation, of racism, of oppression. And it is the very language, it's the very rhetoric that is being used today. I don't want my kids raised around things that are tense about race. I don't want people to be anti-white. It's a White Citizens Council from 1964. Shame on us. Yep. We're going to come back more with Professor Catherine Eden. You're not going to want to miss our last segment. Keep it locked, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Just a little tease, as I was promising last week, tomorrow and Wednesday, I am going to do a very deep dive on the Supreme Court's shadow docket. Because just as you, I hope, have been both educated and somewhat shocked, perhaps, by what Professor Eden and I have been talking about today and learning with you and alongside you, some of the historical facts around the Supreme Court shadow docket are downright frightening, shocking. And again, this is all of a whole. This is all of one tapestry. Without courts okaying the use of taxpayer dollars to fund religiously based education that can discriminate at will without check, we wouldn't be where we are with these things. So you're not going to want to miss that tomorrow and Wednesday. Of course, I'll always give you a little flavor of the most recent day's events, lest we lose that. I wanted to share a couple other facts, Professor, from your article, if I may. And that was that after 1960, so post Brown v. Board, post Little Rock Nine, right? And if you don't know what the Little Rock Nine are, everybody knows about the one little girl, but there were nine folks that there were the nine children that President Eisenhower had to send the National Guard to help out in Little Rock. That after 1960, enrollment in private school decreased, but increased in the South incredibly. Only 3.5% of students in Mississippi attended private schools in 1967. That was 10% in 1972. Why was that happening? Because taxpayer dollars were being diverted to private schools. By 1975, over 750,000 students were not just attending private schools, but were attending private schools that only admitted whites. The Yale Law Journal said that public funding, taxpayer dollars, was vitally important in the founding and support of segregation academies. So I want to ask us all rhetorically this. If you believe that separate is indeed not equal, then what now? Then what do you make of this? Professor Eden, before our break, referenced that in Little Rock, which is a city that is predominantly African American, there exists a school funded by taxpayer dollars that is a private school that has only 8% African American students.
And that's pretty good compared to the other former segregation academies. They're often 2%, 3%. Even in places that are, and maybe especially in places that are majority Black. And, you know, it's killing the economies of these places, because if you want to bring down a major corporation to open up a business in a place like Little Rock or Greenwood, Mississippi, what middle management wants to send their kids to segregation academies? I mean, they're not going to do it. So, and actually one of our respondents from Greenwood, Mississippi, is a city councilman, Johnny Jennings, really spoke to this well. He said, you know, back then we were so proud, but what if we had not been so afraid? What if we had actually had a hamburger after a game, you know, with our black neighbors? What if we'd been in each other's weddings? Would we be where we are now? And, you know, what's amazing is that places like Wisconsin are heading into that awful future that some of the local leaders in the southern states are regretting because it's been such a killer for business and industry in those places. You know, we're all in this together. We succeed or fail together. And if we withdraw from each other, we create situations where everyone loses.
Everyone loses. This is not zero sum. That is, there's such a baked in framework in American thinking. It is so pernicious that if this person that is so unlike me, that I don't know much about and I don't know their lived experience, does better, I by definition must do worse. That is not the way that this stuff works. It just isn't. Yeah. When we do better by folks that are part of historically oppressed groups, white folks do better. I don't know how to put it any other way. Everybody else starts doing better. You can read whatever Harvard Business School study you want to talk about corporate profits, if you need to put it in those terms. But it is exactly the same through any in any sector, including education. And let's be clear. When you create and expand voucher systems, and you end up moving towards a universal voucher system, what you leave in public education is that they are the educators of last resort.
Yes.
Which means the students with the most difficult behavioral issues, with the most difficult mental health issues, with the most difficult poverty issues, because those things run together, because trauma changes our genetic code and our brain pathing. Those are the students that are left in public school systems with teachers that are sometimes not paid enough to be able to afford their own rent and childcare to show up to take care of their children.
They're doing DoorDash.
Yes.
To make ends meet. Yeah. And it's so interesting. So a lot of the voucher opposition in Texas has actually come from homogeneous white communities like you have in Wisconsin, in part because schools hold a community together.
Yes.
You know, in Greenwood, Mississippi, there are 5 high schools in a tiny little town. And so there's nothing to rally around. There's, you know, the town doesn't follow the team because the Black kids are over here, the white kids are over here, the disabled kids are over here. And schools are so important for bringing communities together that many of these rural Texas towns are like, no, we're not going there. We want a place where we can all,
be together.
So I think it'll be very interesting to see how the debate shakes out in Wisconsin, especially in rural communities where schools are already vulnerable due to population loss. And
we
it'll
have
be great.
We have to leave it there. Yes. I'm so sorry, okay. Professor. I could Thank spend you, Maggie. All week with you. Thank you so very much. This has been a Monday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. I hope you feel as educated, but also as hopeful, because now we know what the problems are and we can vote.
That's
our
right.
We can vote our conscience. My thanks to you, Professor Eden, and for everybody for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with more Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.